After a long legal battle, James Meredith became the first African-American student to enroll at the University of Mississippi. This was 1962. His arrival on campus touched off a riot that wounded a number of U.S. marshals and killed two civilians. That's more casualties than any other clash of the civil rights era. It also forever tarnished the reputation of both the school and the state. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about James Meredith and the integration of Ole Miss with historian Charles Eagles, who's taught history at University of Mississippi since 1983. He's the author of a recently published book, and the title is The Price of Defiance. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. It's out now if you want to take a look at it. Professor Eagles, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate
That's
it.
Good.
You know, I think that there are a number of, we could go some way, I could go some way here by asking some very basic questions, and I'm sure we'll be talking about things like why him and why there at Mississippi and why the governor reacted the way he did and why the president of the United States reacted the way he did. But just as a way to start, it seems that you're suggesting in the book that all of these things came together in a way to make a story that was really unlike a lot of the other stories that are part of the civil rights movement.
Yes, I think all the ingredients you just mentioned came together here for a reason, and that is because this is an unusual place, and James Meredith was an unusual person. Obviously, other universities desegregated in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, but this university, I think, had a very special role, and still does for many people, in the white culture of Mississippi. And so that made it all the more important to protect race relations here and preserve white supremacy and white superiority here at the university. It's kind of a symbol for the entire state.
Mm-hmm. I think that James Meredith said something to the effect that the reason that he chose to try to go there was that they had the courses that he wanted to take, that he wasn't trying to make any particular point by trying to go to school there.
I think that's true, at least. In other words, he makes a number of arguments that are not mutually exclusive. He did want to come here because it was the best school in the state and it offered the courses he needed for his major. But I think he was certainly well aware of its symbolic importance, and he knew what Ole Miss meant to the people in Mississippi. So what he said is correct. If he had said the other, if he had said, I'm going there because I know that is a stronghold of the white community, that would not have made anybody happy and wouldn't have furthered his cause. So he had to get, there were a number of motivations going on in his mind, I think.
Mm-hmm. He was not the first African-American to try for admission there?
No, in fact, he wasn't even the first African-American here. During World War II, as part of the war effort, there were training programs for soldiers all over the country. And at this university, there was one, and a man named Harry Murphy actually was enrolled here for a year. And he was an African-American. He passed for white. Everybody here thought he was white. Now, the only thing I can figure out is that, and he's been dead for a number of years now. The only thing I can figure out is on some blank, he must have filled in race and put C, and somebody interpreted that to mean Caucasian, and he meant colored or something like that. But he was part of a military group here on campus, taking courses with students, living in a dorm, but no one knew he was black. And when he realized the mistake had been made, he certainly wasn't going to cause a stir. He just went along with it and completed his program.
Mm-hmm.
But he was here. But you're right. Others in the late 40s and 50s had applied. Some of them just, maybe I should correct that. They had written and sought applications, and the university had deflected them for various reasons. Two people had actually applied to the law school earlier, a man named Charles Dubra and then Medgar Evers in 1954, and their applications were rejected. And then in 1958, another African-American announces he's coming and shows up on campus. But those are other interesting stories.
Perhaps the most fascinating part of this story really involves James Meredith himself. And I think that if you just went with the headline, James Meredith, first African-American student to enroll at University of Mississippi, and probably associated with that some language about pioneering and so forth, you would get one idea of who James Meredith is. And I think when you look at him and his life and what he has done and what he has said about what he's done, he emerges as really a much more interesting and much different person than I think you might imagine.
Well, I think you're right. I would like to get back to the idea, though, that's the most interesting thing here. It is, and we'll talk about that now, but mm-hmm. I want to get on to what I think is also very interesting and people miss.
Sure.
Meredith is. He's a very unusual person, and I don't claim to know him well. I interviewed him for a day in Jackson 10 or 12 years ago, and I have been through a large part of his personal papers, which he gave to the university a few years later. But I think the Meredith that applied here in 1961 is a very disciplined, orderly, thoughtful person. And he had profited from his upbringing on a farm in rural Atala County, Mississippi, with an independent father and mother who were, and by independent, I mean they were really individualists. They did not allow their children, for instance, to work for neighboring whites if they were going to be mistreated. They were proud people, dignified people, and stressed education. And he benefited from that independent spirit, I think, and confidence, and then went into the military and learned the discipline and dedication the military instills in people, sometimes at least. And gradually became aware of race and racial problems in the United States, and became committed to doing something about them when he came home from his Air Force service. And what's interesting to me is that he did this all by himself. He served in the Air Force and in Japan for a number of years, and he was outside the movement. He was not a longtime member of the NAACP or any organization. He didn't have experience in the movement itself. So when he came back in 1961 to Mississippi, he was acting independently, and that is so unusual for most of the things that happen in the civil rights movement. They grow out of grassroots organizations or national organizations or larger aspects of the movement. And he is, in many ways, an individual operator, was in the beginning and has continued to be since.
Mm-hmm. Though I think to me here, there seems to be some sort of conflict or disconnect. I don't know what's the right kind of language to use to talk about what he says on the one hand when he says that what he was interested in was securing for himself and mm-hmm. for people like him the rights guaranteed to any American. And yet at the same time, he did not seem to like to be seen or want to be seen as a crusader for civil rights. Have I got that right?
I think he's very ambivalent about that. I talk about at one point in his time here at the university, he says he's coming back to school, but it's James Meredith the man and not the Negro. He's not going to be a symbol. He knows he is both, and I think he uses each description or each role when it is more valuable to him than the other. So I don't see it as in conflict. I see it as complicated, and I don't see him as hypocritical. He's being very, very practical, and in going through this ordeal, he knows that at various times he is various things. When he is in court, he has to argue his own individual rights, for instance, and his lawyers do, and they understand that he is a test and he does represent all black people, that he represents a class, but they don't present that as part of this larger movement. Mm-hmm. Is that helping at all?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I certainly was not meaning to suggest that he was hypocritical.
I'm just thinking
of him, you know, being a very interesting and complex kind of person, and worth sort of thinking about and listening to the various kinds of things that he's said. And that's what you need to do to try to get if it's possible, to get a more complete understanding of him and what his motivation was.
Yes, and you know, I refer to him in the book, and I imagine some people will quibble with it. I call him a conservative. The phrase I use is I describe him as a militant conservative. He is, in very basic ways, a conservative person. He believes in individual effort. He believes in free enterprise and the capitalist system and working hard. He did not rebel against the military. He really thrived in the military. The organizational demands and the discipline and the order. So he is in many ways a conservative in defending American values and in wanting the basic rights of Americans fulfilled for him and for others. And that is, in some ways, a very conservative position. And he is militant about it. He is inflexible and is determined. Now, I think a lot of people tend to believe that if you are a civil rights activist in this period, you are on the left and you are a radical of some kind and you're opposing the system. And he's not that way at all. And I think that's what has confused people about James Meredith for so long, that his conservatism really does go back to the 1940s and 50s and his upbringing. I say in the book that he combines the conservatism of a Booker T. Washington and that, you know, up by your own bootstraps mentality with the elitism of Du Bois. And he believes in seeking a higher education to better himself and then to lead his people. So that, I think, is what causes some discomfort with Meredith. It is almost innate conservatism. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Charles Eagles. He has taught history at University of Mississippi since 1983, and he is the author of a recently published book. The title is The Price of Defiance, James Meredith and the Integration of Ole Miss. It's published by University of North Carolina Press. Questions are welcome here on the show. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me come back to something that you said in reaction to my comment that I thought one of the most fascinating thing here was mm-hmm. James Meredith himself. And you said, well, yes, certainly that's true. But you also said something like, but there's something else here also that's very interesting and something often that people miss.
Well, I think the thing that I tried to do in the book, and that I hope people will get from it, is that however important Meredith is, and he is the crucial actor in this story, he could not have played that role except for the culture of Mississippi, the culture of white supremacy and segregation in the 1950s. And if that had not been there, there would have been no opposition to what he wanted to do by enrolling at the university. So what I want to do in the first 200 pages of the book is recreate that culture of white supremacy and segregation and discrimination. And I do that in a perhaps an unusual way by looking at the university itself and its involvement in race and how race pulls the university into controversies both on the campus and in the state. And in doing that, give the reader an understanding, almost a feel for what the society in Mississippi was like, what James Silver called the closed society, how it operated, how it functioned, how it played out in a lot of different areas of life. And if you can understand that and see how it works, then you understand what the world was like that Meredith was trying to insert himself into mm-hmm. and assert himself in.
It certainly seems to be the case that a lot of people looked at this school not just as a place to get an education, but as an entry point into the ranks of the state's white elite.
Oh, I think that's true. This is the place where people came to make connections, to in modern-day terminology, to form networks, social networks, economic, political networks of all kinds. And you did that through students you knew, through fraternities and sororities, through student government, and in terms of political power in the state, especially through the law school. And those ties that people made here as students in the going way back, they persist over time. One of the things that I think you have to remember is that Mississippi is a small state in terms of population. And if you realize that the white population here is even smaller, because anywhere from a third to 45% of the population is African American up to the 1950s, then the white population is relatively small, and the educated white population is even smaller. So the ties here are really powerful, because most of those people stay in the state, go back home, perhaps operate their farms, but run the banks and the insurance companies and all kinds of corporations and businesses. And yet the connections they made here are crucial for their lives and their social lives, but also their business lives and political lives.
Mm-hmm.
So this university functioned that way, particularly in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but it's even that way today. I'm sure that we could go across the street and go in the fraternity house and find second or third generation members of that fraternity. And their parents knew each other, and they knew a lot of those guys in that fraternity knew each other before they came here.
So knowing that might help to understand how white people at least would see the admission of a black man, even though at this point we're only talking about one guy. His symbolic significance would loom so large that would be, it would, you almost couldn't describe just what a big thing that would have been.
Yes, and you know, I don't know the culture of Illinois, but I know people come back to your campus to football games, and they're loyal fans.
Oh, sure.
But they have lots of other things in Illinois to distract them and to interest them. In Mississippi in the 19-post-war period, there isn't much. Remember, the two largest cities everybody always says in Mississippi are New Orleans and Memphis. There's not even a large city in Mississippi. So in many ways, the cultural focus, the intellectual focus, the social focus is still on the University of Mississippi for a lot of people.
Apparently, also at this time, there were people at the university that were worried that continuing to keep it closed, maintaining segregation, keeping it all white, would be in the long run bad for the university. How did the university administrators, its trustees, react to the idea of either Meredith particularly being admitted or just the idea of a black person being admitted?
Well, this is why I think the preliminaries to Meredith coming here in 1962 are so important. The chancellor in 1962 had been chancellor for 15 years by the time Meredith came. And he had encountered a series of racial controversies beginning really in 1950, the first public one, I suppose, and going through. And those crises intensify and get greater publicity and cause greater and greater attention to be placed on the university. And what had happened over that period of time is that the chancellor had, unknowingly at first, ceded gradually the control and destiny of the university to the Board of Trustees, to people in the legislature, to the governor, to larger political forces. So that by the time Meredith came, what J.D. Williams, the chancellor, thought really did not matter. And he was, in effect, powerless to do anything. He wasn't even told that Meredith was coming to campus the evening that he came until very late. He was not included in any of the negotiations with the Kennedy administration about about Meredith's enrollment. So by 1961 and 62, the university administration is, for all intents and purposes, irrelevant in this. And that's one of the things I try and show by dealing with controversies over athletics and religion and academic freedom on campus, all of those involving race, is that the chancellor and the administration gradually yield control of their own institution. So now they might have felt one way and thought one way in 1961 and 62, but by that time, it's too late to have made a stand. Hmm.
Let's shift the focus a little bit here and talk about the view from Washington. Why did the Kennedy administration think that this was so important?
I'm not sure that they did at first. They had followed the case, some people in the Justice Department had, from the beginning, but it was not a high priority for the Kennedy administration. Like so many other controversies in the Civil Rights Movement, the outside events tend to force the Kennedys, both the President and the Attorney General, to take a look and then eventually to act. And so they were not committed from the beginning to anything but seeing law and order prevail and court decisions handed down. And the more and more resistance that's put up on the part of Governor Barnett and the Citizens Council and others in the state, they had to respond to that. And they responded, I think, in a very cautious way, in a very reluctant way. And in effect, they couldn't believe that the resistance was developing the way it was. And so finally, when forced, they had to send marshals and eventually troops to enforce a federal court order. But that doesn't, I think, to me, suggest that 6 weeks or 6 months earlier, they really were anxious to do that. They were not.
I think one of the things you argue is that they were surprised by the pushback they got from the governor of the state and from people there, and weren't, at least initially, really weren't prepared to deal with that.
Yes, they thought that Ross Barnett was just some, you know, a third-rate politician in a backwater state, and that he was not very smart, and they weren't prepared to deal with people like that. And I, of course, don't know what Barnett's intelligence was, but pretty clearly, you can't say he was really stupid. He was elected governor and played around with the Kennedys for several weeks on this issue. So he was not an easy opponent for them, and they assumed he would be. They assumed he would be rational, and you explain that the law had to be carried out, and he would just see the justice in that and follow, and he didn't.
There, it seems that, I don't know how many people, but there also were some people in Mississippi who were very concerned that the state would be seen as backward and that this whole thing was very bad for the image of the state of Mississippi. Maybe even there were people who believed that the cost of fighting integration was just too high. Do you have some sense of what public opinion around this issue was?
That's very difficult to gauge. There are some people who are outspoken, even in the 1950s and early 60s, about what should be done about race. Some newspaper editors, a few people in the legislature, but most people seem to either really endorse racial, most white people endorse racial segregation or keep quiet. And so the few people like Hodding Carter, the newspaper editor in Greenville, or Joe Roten, a legislator from Greenville, Mississippi also, or a few ministers in the state who speak up, they are very visible and people are very aware of who they are. Now, once the crisis comes to a climax in 1962 and the riot, then I think you're right. Then some people it does dawn on people that this has gotten out of hand, this is dangerous, this is damaging to the state. And a couple of days later, a group of more than 100 of these people meet in Jackson, and in effect, these business leaders, corporate leaders, political leaders, they say, we can't have this, it's bad for the state. I don't know whether it's possible to gauge whether they have made any significant change in terms of their racial views or not, or what their racial views were before. We simply don't know that. But clearly they had come to the realization some kind of accommodation had to be made.
We're about at our midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Let me introduce again our guest, Charles Eagles. He's taught history at University of Mississippi since 1983 and is the author of a recently published book. The title is The Price of Defiance, James Meredith and the Integration of Ole Miss. And the book is published by the University of North Carolina Press. It has been out, I think, now for a couple of months. So certainly you should be able to find the book if you'd like to read it. Questions here on the program are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about what it is that happened when he arrived on the campus and tried to register and start taking classes there. This is the riot. A lot of people were hurt. A couple of people actually were killed, including a French journalist who was shot. What happened?
Well, originally the plan was to send some marshals to the university and have Meredith register that Sunday afternoon. And the university decided that that was, officials said, we're not going to go along with that. That was inappropriate in a state with as deep religious roots as this one had. And so they refused to allow him to register that evening when he arrived. So Meredith went to a dorm on the western part of campus, almost the farthest point on the campus, away from the middle. And the marshals who had been brought onto campus were left around the administration building, the central building on campus, the oldest building called the Lyceum, and no one knew what to do with them. You have a couple hundred marshals, and you can't just, you know, put them in a motel. And so the decision was to station them there at the Lyceum, and then a crowd began to grow up, to gather in an area across from the Lyceum, what in effect is a big wooded park area called the Circle, and just to see what the spectacle was all about. Now, these are students and other people who have seen Meredith try to enroll several times on campus already, and there had been crowds for each one of those. So they're curiosity seekers, perhaps, and just want to know what's going on. It begins to dawn on people that Meredith is, in fact, on campus, and so the crowd begins to interact with the marshals. There are some highway patrolmen there, too, but they are, for the most part, ineffective. And gradually the crowd builds, and as night falls, objects are thrown, the level of interaction turns to violence, and the marshals cannot retaliate. They have not been authorized to take any action. They're standing in a line in front of the Lyceum, kind of circling it. And eventually, bricks and bottles and really dangerous things are thrown. Marshals are beginning to be hurt. And about 8 o'clock, the chief of the marshals gives the order to fire gas. And by that time, the crowd has grown from, you know, scores of local people and students early in the evening, late in the afternoon when it's still light, to in the darkness, hundreds of people have come onto campus from other places, other schools, other states, trying to stand with Barnett, they think, and oppose the desegregation of the university. And in very quick order, the interaction between the crowd and the marshals turns into serious violence as the crowd riots and the marshals have to retaliate with tear gas, and that goes on for hours. The crowd actually commandeers a fire truck at one point and another point a bulldozer to try and attack the marshals. All of this is hard to understand because Meredith is nowhere around. The people in the crowd really don't know that. What motivates every one of those people, we don't know, but clearly they're angry at the federal government and angry at any kind of racial change. This goes on, and the marshals are besieged, and increasing numbers of them are injured and have to be taken away. The Lyceum, it seems, is not secure anymore, and so eventually the president sends a federalized unit of the National Guard in to protect the marshals and protect the Lyceum. These are native Mississippi whites, but they do their duty. And as the riot continues and guns are fired and it becomes increasingly dangerous, the marshals run out of tear gas or close to it several times. Reinforcements are sent in, and finally the president has to have the United States Army troops sent in early on the morning of October 1st, that Monday morning, to finally secure the campus. Mm.
I think it's interesting, and I think people have made the point about the guardsmen, who, as you say, were native Mississippians, who may have had one set of feelings about this, managed to put those aside and do what they were asked to do and what they were sworn to do as guardsmen.
Well, and once they get there, the minute they arrive on campus in their jeeps and trucks, they are targets. And so, as you can imagine, it doesn't really matter what your views are on lots of issues. If you are being attacked, you want to protect yourself, and they become uneasy allies of the marshals very quickly because they both have the same opponent and they're both trying to survive.
What's known about the circumstances of the two deaths?
The French journalist, it's pretty clear that someone walked up behind him, perhaps 100 yards from the center of the riot, and shot him in point-blank range, and it was clearly a murder. He would have stood out as an outsider because of the way he was dressed, his appearance, and reporters were, from the very beginning, one of the major targets in addition to the marshals, perhaps even more of a target than the marshals were, because the press was seen as intruding. They were obviously outsiders. They did not have to be there, and they were trying to tell a story that people did not want to have told. The other death was just a local man who came and was standing, again, at some distance from the marshals, watching. And pretty clearly what happened to him was he took a stray bullet in the head and was pretty definitely died, if not instantly, very quickly. No one ever identified either one of the people who are the source of the shots. The FBI did, as a layman, it was impressive analysis of all the guns they could find and the bullets and everything to try and determine where it came from, and it never did.
Mm-hmm. We're headed into about our last 15 minutes. This is Focus 580. My name's David Inge, and we're talking this morning with Charles Eagles. He teaches history at University of Mississippi, has been there since 1983, and is the author of a recently published book about James Meredith and the integration of Ole Miss, The Price of Defiance. That's the title, and the book is published by University of North Carolina Press. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. After all this, Meredith, he was admitted, he registered, he attended class, he lived on campus in a dormitory. What was his experience like as a student there?
Well, you know, this is part of the story that I think no one really knows because it's never been told before. I was able to tell it because I got FBI documents and documents from the United States Marshal Service, who were with Meredith all the time. It was pretty awful. He was under almost constant attack by students, verbal attack, verbal abuse almost wherever he went out of his dorm. At first, it was really intense. There were bomb threats. There were disturbances in the dorm, cherry bombs going off all the time. That gradually decreased over first semester with periodic outbursts. And then second semester, it calmed down significantly so that he could, in fact, walk on campus without an FBI or marshal or Army guard right there with him. And so in that sense, it improved over time, but there was always hostility toward him. There were open campaigns to isolate him and to make sure that no white students spoke to him, ate with him in the dining room, or anything like that. So it was a pretty lonely existence. There were some people on campus who made efforts to befriend him. A few students, they suffered serious retaliation by their fellow students, and a few faculty members did. Several faculty members played golf with him fairly regularly on the campus golf course, but for the most part, it was very lonely, and he felt, I think, under threat and under siege at all times.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone who is in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. This is very interesting. My question to you is, I'm from Arkansas, and we claim to be the first southern state to integrate peacefully in 1948 when Silas Hunt was allowed to enter the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville School of Law. That was something that we even champion today. So when we see things like Georgia, and even Alabama with the governor standing in the schoolhouse door, I guess we feel we are different, even though we forget Little Rock Central for a time. My question to you is, what is the legacy of James Meredith in terms of hastening the admission and acceptance of other black students at Ole Miss?
Well, while he was here, he came and enrolled October 1, 1962, and he graduated in August of 63. While he was here, a second student did come to campus and enrolled in the law school. That student was, in the fall of 63, expelled for carrying a gun on campus, and it would then be the next year before another African-American student came on campus. I think what he clearly did was show it was possible, and his example increased the likelihood that other African Americans would apply and get accepted and come here. But it certainly, the experience of blacks who came later was not easy, but he was the one who broke through and showed that it could be done. But the enrollment of African Americans in the university is slow growing in the 1960s and 70s.
What is it now? Do you have any idea what the percentage of the student body is African American?
Yes, right now it must be right at 13%.
Oh, okay.
And that's in a state where a third of the population is African American.
Yeah, that flipped the University of Illinois by several percentage points. I noticed your football team, which always was a bone of contention in the South in terms of allowing black players to play on that. I notice now that there are a goodly number of blacks that play on the Ole Miss football team.
Oh, yes.
The basketball team.
Blacks on the football team, on the basketball team. The current coach is not, but the coach who preceded him was African-American. There are African-American. The president of the student body right now is an African-American. There have been African-American editors of the newspaper. And, yes, they are involved in every aspect of campus life, I guess.
That's great. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So in case anybody should miss the point, you are teaching at the school that we're here talking about, although you arrived there nine years after the events that you write about in the book, so you weren't there at the time.
I came in 83, and this is in 63,
yeah.
So it's 20 years.
Yes.
I was,
yes. Yes, 20 years. 20 years later. So considerably after. And but you know, one of the things that I was wondering about is in you know, to what extent and in what way do people on the campus now talk about these things that happened now in 1962?
That's hard to know. Of course, I teach a class on the Civil Rights Movement, and we talk about him in there. I think it varies from class to class and course to course. Obviously going to be talked about more in political science or journalism than in chemistry or physics. There is a monument to Meredith that was erected several years ago on campus, and kind of a civil rights memorial right between the Lyceum and the University Library in a very prominent place. So I suspect that nearly everyone on campus knows who James Meredith is and knows what happened here, but how much it's a product of day-to-day living, I wouldn't know. I think probably very slight. Most people are more interested in either their coursework or the football team.
Mm-hmm.
As they are at most schools.
No doubt. Well, did this event have an important impact on the state of Mississippi?
Oh, I think it had an important impact on the state and the university. It certainly damaged the reputation of both. The university didn't recover really for almost a generation after this, and I think on the state level, it shocked at least some members of the corporate elite, and they began to realize that accommodations had to be made. So it probably caused some more change at the state level, perhaps, than at the university level. And the next governor, in fact, who had been one of the people who blocked Meredith's enrollment when he was lieutenant governor, the next governor considerably softens his position when he becomes governor. And so I might change my mind tomorrow if I think about this more, but I think it may have had a larger impact on the state leaders than it did on the university leaders.
Mm-hmm. Well, one, I suppose I find myself wondering whether they actually changed their attitudes, or for them this was a pragmatic matter because they were thinking of how it is that people would see the state, and that maybe what they were doing was something that they felt that had to be done for the good of the state, not because they thought it was necessarily the right thing to do.
Oh, I think you're right in wondering that, and there's no way to sort all that out, absent some kind of group psychoanalysis, I suppose, of all these people who are now mostly dead. But in reality, I'm not sure that it makes a great deal of difference, because if the effect is that the situation for African Americans changes, then it doesn't matter so much whether it's out of pragmatism or idealism. I mean, it does in some kind of ultimate sense matter greatly, but if the lives of African Americans and the nature of equal rights in the state changes, I'm not going to quibble if it's out of pragmatism.
Just to return to talk a little bit about Mr. Meredith himself, after having been through this, you would think that here was somebody who would have been positioned to have an important role in the civil rights movement. And he did do that to some extent, but I think that it really wasn't all that long after that that he really stopped being directly involved in the movement, although I think he did have some involvements in politics. He tried to mm-hmm. run for Congress. I think it wasn't really all that long that he essentially dropped out of involvement in politics.
Well, I think he never was a creature of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. He never fit. Those people never accepted him, the people who were in the movement. He was always different. And that is why a lot of people have never been comfortable with him. He's never wanted to be part of the movement the way most people expect him to be. And so to see that he's not involved in the movement in the customary way in the late 60s and 70s shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. He never was. I suggest at least in the 1950s and early 60s, fundamentally conservative in his outlook, and that puts him at odds with many people in the movement. He speaks in 1963 to an NAACP group in Chicago at the National Convention. He doesn't speak to the whole convention, but to a youth group there. And he really is pretty rough on them. He berates them and criticizes their leadership and challenges them, but it challenges them to think that and realize that through hard work they can become heads of corporations, they can become successful businessmen and mayors of cities. That's not the kind of way that people became leaders in the civil rights movement, by going in and criticizing the existing leadership and the existing organization. Mm.
But again, if people were with us earlier, you talked just a little bit more about him and about his upbringing and about his family experience and his life experience before his mm-hmm. Arrival at Ole Miss, and those kinds of attitudes, that's simply who he was. That sounds like he was who he was from the start, and that sounds like who he was when he got there, where you are.
Yes, I think so, and I think he. I have not studied Meredith's career after 63 with any depth or intensity, so I can't pose as an expert there. But I do believe that he's been more consistent over his career than many people are willing to see, because they don't understand that he was not your prototypical civil rights activist in 1961 and 62.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. I want to make sure we get in. We have a couple of minutes left. This is a caller in Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you. Two questions. If he was conservative, I seems like a dichotomy for him to, you know, charge ahead and enroll and go through all he did. And not that conservatism, you know, can't do things like that, but generally it's, you know, those labels, I guess, are pretty bad. But that my second question, I listened avidly every word, and I really appreciate it, but I did miss the part about the fraternities. I was particularly interested because my sorority has actively always been, you know, proactive for integration of races. And I think you said the fraternities were against it and are today. I'm sorry, I did not. I missed that. So thank you.
Sure.
Well, I think to deal with the conservatism first, I'm not talking about conservatism in terms of whether you're for or against health care or Obama or anything like that. I'm talking in kind of a very long-standing, deep-seated appreciation for conservative values, family, education, patriotism, and in Meredith's case, constitutional rights. And he simply believed that in defending those, they should apply to him and people like him. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a conservative belief that leads to perhaps what others would see as kind of radical action.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
As for fraternities and sororities, I'm not suggesting that fraternities and sororities support segregation or have any unusual racial views. In the 1950s and 60s here, though, the fraternities and sororities clearly did not question the prevailing white supremacist culture.
Mm.
And here, what I did suggest is that fraternities and sororities provide the real power of social and political networks in the state. Mm-hmm. That's where people meet each other, get to be friends, and those connections persist often for an entire lifetime. People were identified as students here in the post-war period and earlier by which fraternity they belonged to or which sorority. And they continued to have those ties even after they left the university. They know people who finished here in the 1950s and 60s, and probably today, they can still identify other people they were in school with by the fraternity or sorority they belonged to.
But in general, though, they were for the established attitude at the time, and so you're saying that attitude prevails today. Then?
No, I'm not saying that attitude prevails today.
Okay.
I am saying that they certainly defended it then and were not willing to or interested in any change. They saw no need to change.
Yeah.
I do not know what the attitudes of people in fraternities and sororities are now. I don't think they're probably any different from the general population in the state. I think that's what you have to remember, that the sons and daughters of the people who were in the legislature and making those kinds of decisions, they are the people who in college here in the 1960s. And so to expect them to have radically different views from their parents is unlikely, particularly when the different views are kept out as much as people in the state could. That's what Jim Silver meant by the closed society. It was closed to new ideas.
I want to thank the caller. We're really at the point here where we're going to have to finish. It's a very, very interesting story about a very compelling individual, a compelling and complex individual. And if you'd like to read more, you look for the book. It's titled The Price of Defiance, James Meredith and the Integration of Ole Miss, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press by our guest Charles Eagles. He teaches history there and has since 1983. And Professor Eagles, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.